compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. My number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Change of plan, Cyrus. I'm going to just do something slightly different from what I told you a minute ago before the show started. We need to get a hotkey that says, I told you so, because I think more and more now we're going to need this. And once again, you remember long about May of last year when I was just doing crazy talk on the show about what could happen, you know, with COVID-19 and how it could change things and things we take for granted. And at that time, the churches were closing for a time. And I remember you rolling your eyes, and you told me before you thought it was crazy talk. Like, come on, this stuff's never going to happen, right?
And now you're going to say,
I told you so.
Yeah. Where'd you get that? That's not me, obviously.
No, it's not you.
I don't know who that is.
I don't remember where I got it.
I told you so.
Yeah. Well, I did. I mean, I was speculating, and I wasn't the only one. I don't presume to say that I was the only one who was talking about this. Other people were, but it, you know, looking over the horizon, and I remember more than once we talked about, well, what could happen if it turns out that the vaccine becomes, you know, mandatory or not mandatory. Anyway, just a little tidbit. I just want to throw this out there. This, as of a couple of weeks ago, there's a new bill that has been introduced into Congress. It is House Bill 4980. You can look it up. In fact, Cyrus will post a link to the House of Representatives for the United States Congress, so you can see it for yourself. It's a new bill introduced by a Democrat. This bill, and this is a summary that's posted there, this bill directs the Transportation Security Administration, TSA, to ensure that any individual traveling on a flight that departs from or arrives to an airport inside the United States or U.S. territory is fully vaccinated against COVID-19. The TSA must also ensure that there is an exception to the requirement for an individual who is ineligible or medically unable to be fully vaccinated. And what group that may pertain to, it's hard to say whether you're ineligible or medically unable. But for the rest of you, you're not going to fly on an airplane. If this passes, I have a feeling it will. I was talking with Nancy this morning and we were discussing this, and she said, well, what do you think the chances are that it'll pass? I said, you know, with the current state of things as they are, I think the chances are probably pretty good, at least before the midterm election. If this can get through the lower intestinal tract of the Congress, it may actually become a law. So it's happening. It's happening and happening and happening, isn't it, Cyrus?
It is crazy.
Yeah. So I'm just putting that out there for everybody so you're aware.
I'm posting this on the Twitters right now.
Good. Light up that Twitter. And it's not a law yet. It's just a bill, but it's been introduced, and who knows if it will get through. It probably will, if you ask me, just given the mood of the country. But what that effectively will mean is you will not be able to get on a plane and go somewhere for your vacation or for a job interview or whatever it may be. You're not going to be able to get on a commercial airliner and fly somebody if you're not fully vaccinated. At least as the bill is written right now, that's what that means, unless you fall into one of those ineligible categories. So the more it goes, it seems, the more life is changing little by little. And we're just watching it happen. So FYI, I don't know what else to say on that. So I'll just pass from that. So yesterday, Charlie Watts, drummer of the Rolling Stones, died at age 80. And he was the quiet one. I guess every band has the quiet one, right? George was the quiet one in the Beatles, and I guess he was considered the quiet one. He wasn't always so quiet, though. He was 80 years old, by the way. I'll come back to that. There's a story. You want to tell this story, Cyrus, the one where he punched out Mick Jagger?
That's a great story.
I wish that had been captured on video.
Yeah, I'll have to do it from memory. I don't have that document right in front of me, but it's a pretty short story, and it's great. So Mick and Keith Richards are out. They're out partying. This is in the heyday. This is when Mick Jagger is one of the most popular human beings in the world. Mm-hmm. And they
apparently it was 1984 when this took place.
And if the stories are true, these guys partied really hard. And they came back to their hotel, and They wanted to party some more, so Mick called up the drummer.
Charlie Watts.
And this is, you know, 3-4 o'clock in the morning. He's like, hey, where's my drummer? And Charlie hung up the phone. Then he got up and he shaved and he put on a nice suit and he put on some cologne. And then he went over to Mick's room, knocked on the door. And when Mick opened the door, he punched him right in the face.
Yep. Punched him right in the face.
And he said, I'm not your drummer. You're my singer. That's
yeah.
awesome.
And I would never have expected that from him because he seemed super mild-mannered. And the way Keith Richards tells the story, he had loaned, of course, he says lent because he's British, but he had loaned Mick Jagger a jacket that he had been married in. Doesn't say for which, you know, which marriage he was married in that jacket. But anyway, so Mick Jagger's wearing the jacket. Charlie Watts punches him in the face. He falls to the floor and is in danger of falling out the window into a canal below. This is in Amsterdam. And so Keith Richards says that he grabbed him before he could fall out the window, and he only did so.
Not to save Mick.
Yeah, to save the jacket.
Just to save the jacket. That's a good story.
It's a funny story.
I think I like that story more than I like any of their music.
So let's talk about that for a second. It's interesting you bring up the music. Of course, that's what they're known for. They were contemporaries of the Beatles, and Charlie Watts, age 80, he was older by a year or two than the other guys. Here's what happened. So he went in to the hospital for a procedure, and it was a successful procedure, and it was the result of a condition that he had during. They found this problem during a routine checkup. It's not disclosed what it is. So he went and he had a successful procedure done. A couple weeks later, boom, he's dead. Suddenly, you know, he's 80 years old. So these things, when you get toward that end of life, you know, it's not unexpected. It's not shocking. But what I thought about when I saw this story, first of all, was I thought about the Rolling Stones career. And not all, I mean, plenty of it was like really bad stuff. I was never really a fan of the Rolling Stones. And the reason I wasn't a fan was because once I started becoming aware of some of the really objectionable things they did, like their album, Their Satanic Majesty's Request, Goat's Head Soup. One of the songs on that album is called Mr. D, and the lyrics go, down in the graveyard where we have our tryst, the air smells sweet, the air smells sick. He never smiles, his mouth merely twists, the breath in my lungs feels clinging and thick, but I know his name, he's called Mr. D, and one of these days he's going to set you free. I don't even like saying those words, but I use them as an illustration of some of the really evil things in their music that it just kind of repelled me. So when I was young and indiscriminate in my interest in bands and things, I knew enough to say, this is not good. I'm not going to listen to this. I'm not going to follow this group. And I'm glad I didn't. I mean, they came out with some snappy numbers, some hits that people like, and I can appreciate that. But as far as the group itself was concerned, it made me think of all that when I saw the news that Charlie Watts died yesterday. So I'm thinking about, you know, the mega success that they had, hyper mega success, the vast fortunes, the platinum records, the sold out tours, the groupies, the limousines, the champagne, the you know, the expensive chateaus in France and around the world, their homes, and all of the jet-setting lifestyle that happens when you reach that level of fame. And he's dead now. That, for me, was the essence of this story. It's all over. It's all gone. And I don't know, and I don't presume to, you know where he went. Did he go to heaven or hell? I hope he went to heaven. But I have a feeling that, I mean, man, can you imagine the exit interview that somebody in that position who has spent, and I'm not talking specifically about Charlie Watts per se, but, you know, take your pick, you know, pick some celebrity, and I don't mean to pick on them, but they are object lessons for you and for me, and that is, you know, you think that it's difficult to not have enough money to, you know, get a new pool in your backyard, or difficult because you'd rather drive a newer car, and you know, most all of us have to deal with things like that. We have to deal with a budget and hard work and commuting. When you're at that level, those kinds of problems go away. And you have money galore and you have adulation and everybody's fawning over you. And okay. But that's going to end at some point, and you can't take it with you. Jesus said in Matthew 16, he said, "For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and then he will repay each person according to what he has done." So, yeah, let's say a prayer for Charlie Watts, that he died in the state of grace. How likely is that? I'd hate to speculate. Maybe he did. Maybe he became religious later in life. You know, what about Mick Jagger? What about Keith Richards? These guys look embalmed. I mean, they look as if they've already passed to the other side and they're still going, but they won't be going forever. Eventually, this will all come to a conclusion. And the money and the mansions and the limousines and the groupies and the platinum records and all of that stays here. And none of it means anything ultimately anyway, at least not in an eternal perspective. I'm pretty confident that when the Lord has his exit interview with Mick Jagger, yesterday it was Charlie Watts, I'm pretty sure that the number of albums they produced or the number of hit singles they came out with will not be on the list of things to discuss. It would be my guess. So anyway, that's it for me. I mean, I see this as, again, an object lesson that you and I can benefit from. And when I see something like this in the news, I don't bring it up just so we can talk about pop culture. You know, those are empty calories. But very often pop culture can provide us with lessons that can help us. What do you think, Cyrus? You mentioned earlier something of the autobiographies of the stars that I've been reading over the summer, right?
Yeah, just with what you've been saying, these, you know, people living in that moment of being the top dog and money's not a problem, and they're living a decadent lifestyle and the choices they're making, and that's a moment, and that moment passes, and now they're older, and you have to answer for the life you lived.
Yeah.
You've talked about the actress. I know I can't think of her name now.
Oh, Terry Garr.
Right, and yeah. It seemed like she had some. She's not a Rolling Stones lifestyle, but you know, still a.
She had a similar kind of lifestyle. You're right about that. So she's still alive and she's not doing well health wise.
Stevie Nicks. She talks about how. Yeah, if think of all the music I wouldn't have been able to give people if I would have had that baby.
Yeah, the abortion and she freely talked about it. It's not like we're prying into her private business.
Right.
She was very vocal and public about how she's glad she had the abortion. You're right.
I speculate there'll be a time where she's going to reconsider that thought process and be like, I made a mistake. Just like,
I hope so.
Like that letter you read a couple months ago of the, wasn't he an Italian superstar?
Italian.
He was an actor. That's one of my favorite moments ever on the show, is having you read that letter. It was beautiful.
That was so hard for me to get through. And I started it like, okay, this is fine. I can do this. And the more I got into it, the more I started imagining myself as if, you know, if God forbid that had been me. And then it was just overwhelming. So... yeah. And when I hear that, I think it's a promo, isn't it? We have a snippet of that being played.
Yeah, I should look for it and see if we can play that again. Just grab the whole thing, not just a snippet.
Yeah.
It's really powerful. And this is what I'm hoping people like Charlie Watts have had, is a...
conversion.
A conversion, yeah. You got to wake up sometime.
Bill Paxton, you remember him? Game over, man. Game over, man. Yeah. He was in so many great movies. So that was from Aliens. He was in Titanic and Tombstone and just a ton of very good movies. Apollo 13. And he went in for from what I understand, it was like a routine heart procedure. Maybe it was they were going to put a stent in. Maybe they were going to do a little something. I don't know. But it wasn't supposed to be a major deal. And he died on the operating table, from what I understand. I believe he had a stroke. And it was unexpected. He was about 61, if I'm not mistaken, and healthy by all accounts. So not to dwell on morbidity here, but these are good examples for all of us that you don't know when your life will end. You have no clue. And, you know, I think we all assume that we will live at least 70 years. Some people get away with maybe an extra 10. Charlie Watts got an extra 10 on top of the 70 years. Some people live a little longer than that, but most everybody is gone by the time you reach your mid-80s. Most people go before that, but all I'm saying is you don't have any guarantees in this life when will your life end. And this is a passage I return to often, and I'll just leave it at this because I don't want you to feel like I'm grinding on this topic, but it is worth noting because, after all, dying is the most important thing you'll ever do. Stop and think about that for a minute. Dying is the most important thing you'll ever do. What I mean by that is the state of your soul when you die determines everything. It determines whether you go up or you go down. And there's always time while you're in this life to repent, to turn back to the Lord, to receive his mercy and forgiveness, to amend your life. And this is, you know, maybe speaking to people who are living in a kind of chronically sinful existence. There's always time, but eventually the time will run out. And then, of course, there is no more time. Hebrews 9:27, it's appointed to a man to die once and then the judgment. So when you look around and you see these celebrities with fantastic careers and all of the things that they got by way of worldly benefits, and you see that that's all left behind, of course, and then where do they go? Do they go up or do they go down? Do they go to heaven? Do they go to hell? And Jesus himself said, as you know, he says, I tell you, unless you repent, you will also all perish. So repentance is key. And what if you don't have time to repent? What if you're living in the state of chronic sinfulness and you get in a car accident? You didn't even see it coming. You don't even realize you're dead yet because it happened so fast. The next thing you know, it's time for the exit interview. And there was no time to repent. I love this verse, and I'll leave it at this. We have to take a break, but think about this. This is from James chapter 4. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we shall go into such and such a town, spend a year there doing business and make a profit. You have no idea what your life will be like tomorrow. You are a puff of smoke that appears briefly and then disappears. Instead, you should say, if the Lord wills it, we should live to do this or that. That's one of the passages I read maybe most often. I have a bunch that I like to read. That's one of them, and I like to think about that often because the more you prepare and the better you prepare by God's grace, the more ready you're going to be. And those who are, I think anyway, perfectly joyful, perfectly content with their lives are the ones who are prepared to go at a moment's notice. And if it should happen that it takes them by surprise, okay, they're ready. They're ready to go. Bags are packed, and you have money in the bank in terms of that heavenly treasure that you can lay up for yourself. Okay, we'll end that. We'll take a break. We'll come back. My number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. You can call me now. We have lines open right now. I'll be right back. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Seriously, Cyrus, whenever I hear this song, the only thing I can see in my mind's eye is Bill Gates dancing awkwardly to this song.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, I mean, that is the image now for this song forever.
That's funny.
Yeah. We're going to go to the phones real quick, though, courtesy of PJ Media. Last December, a federal grand jury found 50-year-old Michael Harry guilty for his role in bombing the Dar al-Farouk Islamic Center in Bloomington, Minnesota, back in 2017. He was convicted of civil rights violations and hate crimes. Today, Mike Hari now identifies as Emily Claire Hari, according to federal Minnesota Assistant Public Defender Shannon Elkins. Elkins alleges that Hari is suffering from gender dysphoria and says that absorbing right-wing anti-Muslim content online has resulted in an inner conflict that led to the attack. So the attack aside, he now identifies as a woman. And if you see his picture, I think you'll find pretty quickly that he's a biological male. I actually wish he had changed his name not to Emily Claire Hari, but to Carrie Hari. That would have been at least, you know, a bright spot in this story. Carrie Hari?
He looks like that would fit his name too.
Carrie Hari. Does that ring any bells?
Carrie.
There you go. Elkins recently filed court papers asking U.S. District Judge Donovan Frank to give Hari 30 years in prison rather than a life sentence that was sought by prosecutors. Elkins claims Hari brought military fatigues for his so-called missions. He also purchased female clothing for a planned trip to Thailand for surgery, and I won't explain why. He was living a double life. No one was killed in the mosque bombing. His two co-defendants have pleaded guilty and are also awaiting sentencing. Hari is a regular guy, looking to spend the next three decades in a women's prison. They're wondering, is this why he's changing his identity to Emily Claire Hari so that he can live in a women's prison, or is he, you know, what is his deal? I guess the question that they ask in the headline is this an example of toxic femininity? If he actually is a woman, which some people might believe that, and then assign him to a female prison, is that toxic femininity? Or what is that? And if they say, well, no, it's not toxic femininity. Come on. It's toxic masculinity. What are you talking about, toxic masculinity? He's a woman. I mean, he says he's a woman. We put him in with the women in that prison. We'll see how that works out. It's crazy. But it's the new world we live in. So please take note, Cyrus, because the rules change every so often. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Joanne in Fort Myers, Florida. Hi, Joanne.
Oh, hello, Patrick. When you mentioned about Charlie Watson and the Stones, I had a friend who was a merchandise manager with the Stones and toured with them.
Uh-huh.
And she told me that the crew and most of them were high most of the time.
I'm not surprised to hear that.
I'm not either. But my point is, and I have I won't mention who, but I have a couple of family members who are celebrities, and one uncle that worked in the movie industry and one in the music industry. And the reality is, no matter how much fame and fortune that they acquire, they're missing something, and they have to escape life through drugs and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they were happy with their lives, there's no reason for escapism.
Yeah, I think I don't have any doubt that that's true for some people. I don't know if it's true for every celebrity. I don't think that every celebrity is just wallowing in misery, but I can sure see where some are. We talked yesterday about Tom Petty and Prince, and a lot of their problems stemmed from bodily pain, from injuries, and that caught up with them. You know, one of the people, who was it, Cyrus? Maybe you can jog my memory because I don't remember. We talked about a celebrity. I talked about a celebrity on the show in recent weeks, and it was revealed that his biggest single problem was loneliness. Do you remember who that was? I'm just blanking on who that was. And he just always felt lonely.
I'll see if I can look back through the notes.
Yeah, I don't know if it's important but to look for it, but it really struck me. Somebody who, very famous, very well-known and very wealthy, probably like the people you know, Joanne, and just terribly lonely.
I mean, think of Robin Williams.
Yeah.
I mean, that's someone that made everyone around him laugh, but inside he was lonely.
Good point. Which is kind of what you're talking about, Joanne, right?
Yes, man, in a sense, yeah. And I think the loneliness comes from this. I'm just a middle-class person, and we know who our true friends are. Mm-hmm. They're not with us because we have fame and fortune. But just think about their lives. They never know if a person really loves them or likes them or is with them because of their celebrity. And that's, I think that's the part where the loneliness, that's the part where the loneliness comes in, and the insecurities come in. They're very famous people who are actually very insecure people.
You know, I just, you're, what you said just jogged my memory. It was William Shatner who played Captain Kirk on Star Trek. He's 90 now. And in his, you know, more candid moments, he reveals, as he says, a huge aspect of his fame involved loneliness, because like you said, all the hangers-on and the people who want to be around the celebrity, and a lot of it, I guess, wasn't sincere, and he just was starved for friendship.
Right. Well, because they questioned all their relationships. Now, we don't have to do that.
Thankfully, no, we don't. And, well, remember what Jesus said. I'll leave it at this, and I thank you for the call, Joanne. He said that, you know, it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, he's not saying that rich people can't go to heaven. They're, I'm sure we'll meet many rich people in heaven. But his point is it's more difficult if your arms are loaded down with all the nice things of the world, if you're so busy managing all the wonderful money and homes and limousines and all that. You don't have a lot of room for God. And there's also no incentive in a worldly sense to rely on God for anything, because you can buy whatever you want. You know, I see celebrities who sell homes in Southern California, and, you know, they sell a home for $15, $20 million, $25 million. When you can buy and sell things at that level, very, very few people will ever get to that level. But I guess what Jesus is saying is count yourself lucky, count yourself blessed, more like it, that you don't have to deal with that level of wealth, because with that level of wealth comes not only more distractions, but also much more difficulty in using it in a way that glorifies God. Yeah, very interesting. Let's go now to Barbara in Passaic, New Jersey. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I'm calling to ask, do you think with everything going on in our country or even the entire world, we are all under satanic attack?
In a sense, I do, sure. I mean, St. Peter said in 1 Peter 5, he says, be sober, minded, and watchful. Your adversary, the devil, is prowling around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. So that seems to be a sort of ubiquitous reality, that the devil and his minions are out there looking for opportunities. So if that's what you mean by satanic attack, yeah, I do think so.
Well, with the virus and with all the violence in the United States and what's going on in Afghanistan and all over the world with the virus, that kind of thing specifically.
I see. Well, that's hard for me to know. I don't think that, well, I'll put it this way. If you consider human history, let's say from the time of Christ forward, you'll see tremendous amounts of evil and bloodshed and violence and just terrible things being done, in some cases on a very large scale. So one of the temptations of our generation, really probably any generation, is to assume that this is as bad as it's ever been. It's never been this bad. It's always, you know, sort of, we look back to the supposed good old days. I don't think that we're under any more satanic attack generally than times gone by, but we do have, and maybe this gets to the heart of your question, Barbara, we do have testimony from people like Pope Leo the 13th, rather, who composed the St. Michael the Archangel Defend Us in Battle prayer after God gave him a vision of the coming century in which he permitted the devil to run wild and to inflict great damage, more so than before. If that's the kind of thing you're thinking about, is the devil more active, or does he have less constraint on him? I would say probably, that makes sense to me.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Yeah, not a wonderful topic to think about, but you know, that's where that prayer for St. Michael the Archangel, defend us in battle, that's where that came from. Pope Leo the 13th had just finished celebrating Mass, and his helpers and assistants who were there with him, they saw him look like he went into a trance. He just turned white, and he was pale, and he was trembling, and he was seeing something, and they couldn't see whatever he was seeing. And when he came out of this, he told them that God had granted him a vision. And in this vision, he saw what the devil would do in the coming 100 years. And so he immediately sat down, got a pen and paper and you wrote out that prayer. Saint Michael the Archangel, defend us in battle. And it was to be recited at the end of Mass for all Masses in the Latin Rite of the Catholic Church. And oddly enough, after the Second Vatican Council, that was abrogated. And so it was no longer a prayer that was to be recited after Mass. I sure wish it had been kept. Maybe we wouldn't be in as much of a fiasco as we are now. 888-914-9149. How about Oakland, Illinois now to talk to Joseph. Hi, Joseph.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome.
My question is, if you can explain the lowly sinner and that meaning you have in the past, and I just would like to hear it again.
Sure. Do you mean like where Jesus says, blessed are the meek, blessed are the lowly, blessed are the peacemakers?
Yes, sir.
In the Beatitudes? Okay. Well, I mean, I understand that to mean humility. So lowliness is what Our Lady talks about in Luke chapter 1, where she says that the Lord has done great things for his lowly servant. I'm not quoting from memory, but let me get my Bible out, and I will quote that to you. But she says it in contradistinction to the wise and the high and the mighty, the people who are anything but lowly. I think that's what Jesus is referring to there. So here's what Our Lady says. She says, my soul magnifies the Lord and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior, for he has regarded the low estate. And this passage here, sometimes we'll translate this as lowliness. For he has regarded the low estate of his handmaiden. For behold, henceforth all generations will call me blessed. For he who is mighty has done great things for me, and holy is his name. And his mercy is on those who fear him from generation to generation. He has shown strength with his arm. He scattered the proud in the imagination of their hearts. He has put down the mighty from their thrones and exalted those of low degree. He has filled the hungry with good things, and the rich he has sent empty away. So my thinking, in answer to your question, is that as Our Lady is speaking about here, God blesses those who are humble, and maybe their lowliness is not in terms of what they do for a living. Maybe it's a high-powered corporate executive who happens to be very humble, or maybe a very successful physician, and she happens to be very humble in the sense of virtue. I don't mean just humble like in a natural way. I think that's what he's talking about. That's my impression. And I think we might have lost him because he's not there. So anyway, that's how I read it. I hope that's helpful to you. We'll take a break and we'll come back with more of your phone calls. The number is 888-914-9149. Those of you who are holding on, please keep holding on. I'm going to come to you right after this timeout. 888-914-9149. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com. Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now.
That's right. This is a good vibe for today's show. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Francine now in Chicago. Hi, Francine.
Hi, Patrick. I'm calling about the comments on artists and musicians and famous people using drugs. And it was mentioned that there's a deep loneliness in them. As an artist in many fields, the loneliness that I sense in myself is from not being able to find kindred spirits, people who truly understand me, who know and vibrate on the same level I do. Mm-hmm. The use of marijuana, in my case, helps me to rise above the heavy, dense, thick, fearful energies of humanity especially in these days when fear-mongering is so rampant, and to tune into other channels where I can reach the creative forces. My best writing, my best artwork has come by the use of marijuana. You don't have to use a lot of it. One little toke, and suddenly the world is clearer and brighter, and I'm not absorbing the heavy energies of the world around me. I don't know how to explain it if you're not there.
Mm-hmm.
But
I've never smoked marijuana myself, not even once, so I don't have any personal experience. But when I was growing up, and this may probably doesn't describe your situation, Francine, but when I was, you know, in high school and playing in bands and stuff, I mean, everybody was always smoking pot, always. And a little bit after high school, it was cocaine, but pot was always, it was just ubiquitous. And looking back on it, I don't know how it passed me by. I just never smoked it. I never tried it. And I have a hard time relating to that whole idea of smoking pot to get, I don't know. I mean, describe that for me, because I've never experienced it. Are you saying that you have more information in your mind, or you see things more clearly when you smoke dope?
Yes, my mind is open to, it's like changing the channel on a TV. My mind becomes more open to receive inspiration.
Okay.
To hear the higher forces, I guess.
How often do you do it?
It depends. It depends on how I'm feeling and the people I've talked to lately. I'm pretty much of a loner, because I find people to just be heavy, dark.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm around people who are just always complaining and grousing and angry and fearful and nothing is right, boy, I'll tell you, just one toke of one smoke of there, it doesn't have to be a lot. And there's a lightness of being that comes over me, that lifts me up, that takes me out of the horrific world that is around us. Sensitive people, artists, composers, actors, are sensitive people, and they sense the energies around us that others do not.
Fair enough. People
are living in them. They are a part of them, and we can't be a part of them if we're going to create.
Fair enough. Who am I to argue? I don't endorse smoking marijuana. As I say, I've never done it myself. I'm not here to judge you or anyone, Francine, so that's not my point. But I think that life is better without that. And, you know, that's just my perspective. What can I say? I appreciate the call, though. Thank you. Cyrus, we've talked about this before, and that is that, you know, I'm actually still kind of angry about this. The Beatles, you know, they had smoked marijuana and stuff like that, but it was George Harrison's dentist who snuck, was it LSD? I believe it was. He snuck some LSD into the tea of John Lennon and George Harrison. They were having dinner, and so he spiked their tea with LSD. They didn't know what it was. They didn't know it was in there, and that's what got them hooked, for a time anyway, on LSD. I mean, that guy should have been banned. He should have lost his license.
He should be in jail. That's criminal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It doesn't matter that it's the Beatles that he did it to. You do that to anybody.
Here's what John Lennon said. This is in 1970. He says, he laid it on George, me, and our wives without telling us at a dinner party at his house. He was a friend of George's and our dentist at the time. He just put it in our coffee or something. He didn't know what it was, he being George didn't know what it was. It was just, it's all the thing with the middle-class London swingers. They had all heard about it and didn't know it was different from pot or pills, and they gave it to us, and he was saying, I advise you not to leave. And we thought he was trying to keep us for something at his house, and we didn't want to know what it was. But eventually, of course, they went on to become heavy users of LSD. So that always has irritated me since I found out about that. But that's how the Beatles got started. And, you know, the argument goes, and this is, I suppose, tying into what the lady I just spoke to was saying, and that is the Beatles attributed some of their big hits to taking drugs. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, I mean, that's, you know, LSD. Does that really refer to it? I don't know. I think they denied that it does. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, it's mind altering, and I don't know that that's in the long run going to help. I have another theory though, and I want to share this on the heels of what the lady I just spoke to was sharing. And she, remember, she was talking about as an artist, she's more creative if she smokes marijuana, and she started by saying that her sense is that these creative people, these megastars, actors, musicians, etc., that they need that because loneliness and maybe not feeling that they have true friends. And I don't deny that that could be the case. I have another theory, though. My theory of choice is that the Robin Williams of the world, the Charlie Watts, you know, the Rolling Stones, Beatles, all these megastars, each in their own way, I think that the loneliness is really their realization that nothing satisfies them. The women, the money, the mansions, the food, the clothing, the exotic things they can buy, the fun they can have. I imagine it'd be a lot of fun to play at, you know, Wembley Arena in London in front of 100,000 people doing a rock concert. That must be a lot of fun. I've never done that, but I'd like to do that. You know, maybe in my mind's eye, I suppose. But after a while, none of it is fun anymore. After a while, you just get tired of it. And you know, if you're partying constantly and all you have is just one endless continuation of pleasure, and you're moving from one pleasure to another, to another, to another, eventually you just get tired of it and you get lonely, because you realize, even if you don't articulate this in your mind, I think that's the source, maybe more than any other source, that's the source of their loneliness. They have friends, they have groupies, they've got everything, but nothing is going to satisfy them ultimately. Only God can, of course. As St. Augustine said famously in his Confessions, he said that our hearts are restless, O Lord, until they rest in thee. And yeah, I mean, it's to me, it seems self-evident that if you're just seeking pleasure, and in the case of people like this, you can have all the pleasure you want, endless amounts of pleasure, but ultimately that doesn't satisfy you, and you have this void, and you have a gnawing hunger for something. In the case of those who are not religious, you don't quite even know what it is. You're not sure what it is. Maybe that's why they go through so many marriages. Maybe that's why they go through, you know, they blow their money on frivolous things, and some of them wind up bankrupt by the time it's all over, because they're searching for that satisfaction that they can't get. And I'm going to resist the temptation to refer to the Rolling Stones in that regard. They can't find what they're looking for. And for many of them, that leads to despair. And I don't know. I mean, that's my theory. Cyrus, what do you think? Thumbs up or thumbs down? I think that is probably more often than not the reason why these mega celebrities are so lonely.
I don't know where I heard it, but someone said there's a God-sized hole in their hearts, and they try to fill it up with anything they can other than mm-hmm. God. And so they're
true.
And when you take the drugs, it probably alleviates that pain for a moment, but it's always going to come back.
It numbs it.
There's only one thing that's going to fill that hole.
If you have an infected tooth, yeah, I agree with you. If you have an infected tooth, you can take medication to numb the pain or even take the pain away for a while, but you still have an infected tooth.
That's right.
And until you fix that, you know, you can numb the pain all you want, but
it's
just masking.
And it's going to just keep hurting worse and worse and worse. And it's going to take more to mask it and more to mask it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going
to go God, away. God pursues everybody. God gives enough grace to everybody to be saved. But if you're in a fog of that kind of lifestyle, I mean, heck, you don't have to be at that level to be in a fog. You know, your workaday lifestyle can be a fog enough. But if you're distracted by the things that don't really matter, God is not going to force himself on you. He's not going to batter your door down. Jesus said, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. And anyone who opens, I will come inside and have supper with him." But Jesus is, he's knocking, but he's not going to take a battering ram and break your door down. You have to open it. And he'll come in. But if you don't open it and your life ends, that's it. Your chances are over. So I don't want to get back on that track because I don't want people to think that this is the hour of preaching or anything like that. But loneliness is a common human phenomenon. We all experience it in one way or another. But I really do believe that the people at these higher levels of wealth and fame, they must experience it in a much more acute way for the reasons aforementioned. 888-914-9149. How about Jeff now in Neenah, Wisconsin? Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to comment to the woman that called that was an artist and liked to smoke marijuana every whenever she needed to get away and get into her different place. I'm an artist as well, and I've had marijuana in my life, and I had an event happen to me at where God and Satan was in my presence at the exact same time. And my message was, make your choice. I'm going to give you a second chance in life right here. And
were you wide awake when this happened?
Moment. I was awake and driving and passed out, basically.
Okay.
And I went to the into a field through a fence and across a lane of traffic and should have been killed, could have killed a family of people in a car. I completely didn't know where I was for a few seconds. I woke up while in this field and driving, and I was in the presence of good and evil at the exact same time.
Okay.
God gave me a choice. He said, make your choice now. When you do this, you need to do this. One of them was pray the rosary every day. And he said, you have your choice. You can either continue down that path or you can go the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And I chose immediately to go with God. And I have not touched that since, and I will never do it again. I'll never smoke again. And I know that God was there telling me that this is interfering with your communication with me, is what he told me. And I just want other people to know that all this rampant smoking of pot, it's just the devil. The devil is tempting you. And I know that because I've experienced it.
In this momentary flash of reality that you had this choice to make, did you discern any message coming from the evil one?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He was on the other side of the vehicle with me. Oh, don't listen to that. You just have another one. You'll be okay. Here, just have another one.
Did God really tell you that if you eat the fruit of the tree that you will surely die? Come on. God just doesn't want you to be like him. He's a liar, isn't he? And he lied to you in the car that day, didn't
he? Exactly. And I know it because I was there. And I wish I could just show this in my mind to everyone else so that they could see exactly what happened and the feelings and the emotions and the presence of both of these entities. I could call, I hate to call God an entity, but God.
His presence.
But maybe it was a presence. Maybe it was an angel. Maybe it was my guardian angel. But the message came from God.
And right. That is.
I've never missed a day of Mass since. I go to confession. I do my rosary every day. My life is so much better. And I don't need to go into that little pocket of, I got to get away for a minute. I got to go get more energetic and more creative with my life here because my drawing will
be better.
Do you
find that you're more? Are you more creative now than you were when you were smoking marijuana? Or less?
I don't.
Or about the same?
I don't think I'm more creative. It doesn't make any difference that way.
So you don't notice an uptick or a downtick. It's just about the same for you anyway.
I think I'm still battling with, I think that there's forces that are keeping me from the drawing board. I get over to the drawing board and I start working and I get, here comes that distraction. Here he comes. He's going to do something else to distract my creativity today. Yeah. And but I worked through it. And I was,
Cyrus, you have a point you wanted to make in relation to what Jeff is saying. What was that, Cyrus?
Yeah, Stephen King, back in the early days of his writing, he was doing cocaine and he was drinking alcohol. He drank so much alcohol and he was trying to hide it from his wife that he would drink Listerine. There were just bottles of Listerine.
He'd drink it?
He'd drink it. He would drink the Listerine. He was so coked up while he was writing Cujo that he would write with toilet paper stuffed up his nose. And he thought that's the only way he could write. And all of a sudden, he had two kids and a wife, and who he's still married to, by the way. And she was going to leave him. And so he got clean and sober for her. And he's still clean and sober to this day. You know, this is 35 years later.
Yeah. Still cranking out hits.
He's still cranking, and he's still married, and he's got a wonderful family.
And he's sober. Hey, Jeff, thank you. I appreciate it. We'll be right back. We're going to ride this wave for a while longer, so stick with me. I'll be right back.